We talk about a wide range of topics on this program, and we certainly are doing that again today. I'm really pleased to have the author of a memoir that explores a whole bunch of things. It explores chronic depression, hoarding, religion, and perhaps most importantly, the relationship between mothers and daughters. Larry Mueller here, and my guest today is Mary Flom Peterson. Mary's a veteran, multi-Emmy award-winning producer for Good Morning America, former producer and reporter for CNN. She's also the author of the book White Dresses, a memoir of love and secrets, mothers and daughters. A lot of the book is, in a way, set in Beaver Dam, Wisconsin. And so Beaver Dam pops up pretty often in her discussions of the book. I hope you'll call in with your own questions and comments. Maybe you've read the book already and have some comment about it. Number 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Or you can even tweet us, if you'd like, at L. Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And Mary Flom Peterson with us in our Milwaukee studios. Mary, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really honored to be with you.
Oh, I tell you what, I read your book, and I really, you're such a great writer. And I thought, oh my goodness, this must have been a difficult book to write, because in some ways, because you really, let's see, how many cliches can I use here? You've left no stone unturned. No skeletons are left in the closet, apparently.
Well, it's first of all, thank you for the kind remarks about the quality of the writing. The book actually, I think it surprises a lot of people, wasn't as hard for me to write as I think even I thought it might be. I didn't intend for this to be a book, and I was just speaking with a group here in Milwaukee last night, a lovely group of women at the University Club, and I was telling them that I didn't realize that my family might be that interesting to other people, believe it or not. Which some people find surprising if they've read the book, and I'm told the book reads like something like a novel or even a soap opera, which, as a longtime soap opera fan, I have mixed feelings about. But no evil twins in the book, though, I will say. I didn't think that my family and my story was something that I was going to be writing about. I had taken a writing class at my kids' preschool a couple of years ago. My mother had died recently, and I had just had our fourth child in 5 years. We have four little ones. And I had a daughter. It was my first girl after three boys. And I found myself in this interesting situation where I had been very close to my mother. I missed her mightily. And now I was in this new mother-daughter relationship where I was the mother and she was the daughter. I was thinking a lot about her, but I didn't think it was worthy of a book. And I was polishing off a kind of a fluffy novel in this class, but a wonderful writing instructor asked us to write an in-class essay about three classes into the session about where we got our names. And I wrote about my name being Mary, and it had come from my mother and a vision she said she'd actually had when she was a nun. That's a whole chapter in White Dresses. And the book kind of flowed from there. The class really loved this essay. They loved my mention of my mother's rather complicated life of going from a nun to going on to thinking she was getting her happily ever after when she met my father, and then my father revealed himself to be gay. There were a lot of twists and turns, and so as I sat down to start writing these essays, they quickly formed into what you now see as White Dresses, but it was rather less difficult and more, I think, cathartic as I wrote it. I just never thought in 1,000 years it was going to be interesting enough for other people to want to read. I thought I was writing it more for myself, and now here we are.
Well, it's a pretty interesting book, if you ask me. I really found it fascinating, actually. And I know people are going to say, well, why did you call it White Dresses? And you should explain that.
Well, the book White Dresses, it starts with, it's really about three generations of a rather complicated Catholic family here in the Midwest. It concentrates on my mother and me largely, and then to a small degree, my infant daughter and the white dresses that we wore. For my mother, white dresses were like so many families. I think certainly a lot of Catholic families, but I think families in general, white dresses are very significant. They and the old rule, which my mother really had me adhere to, you only wore white dresses between Memorial Day weekend and Labor Day weekend, and you did not wear them in between unless it was pretty special. It had to be a wedding. It had to be a christening, a graduation dress.
Confirmation.
Correct. It was something significant. Or in the case of when my mother became a nun, the many people don't know when a woman becomes a nun, she's a bride of Christ and she actually wears a wedding gown. So my mother looked like a very, very pretty bride on her on the day she took her vows, which I didn't discover actually until I was in college. But in any case, white dresses were something that were significant to my mother, and in turn she passed on to me, like a lot of mothers and daughters do, that those were special dresses. And when I looked back at our life together as mother and daughter, I really realized, as both a writer and a journalist and a daughter, it was an interesting way to kind of trace our shared history, our highs and our lows. So many of the days that we wore these special dresses of weddings and whatnot were these very mixed feeling days. But my mother always believed in the significance of the color white. And I'm sorry for scientists out there. I know white doesn't qualify officially as a color. I'm going to call it a color. You can just for today, anyway.
But I think 99.99% of the people listening today are not going to disagree.
Okay. So in any case, white was my mother always viewed as almost a way of setting a reset button. She even believed that in the winter time, it was like a nice reset button to get everybody ready for spring and summer. So that was also significant. There was a lot of dark times in my mother's life and in turn in our shared family life, but she always believed around the corner was something light. And I think the church believes that as well. White is always a symbol of renewal, which is why we wear it on all those significant days.
Your mother, I actually want to go back a little further, because her mother, your grandmother, was it Aurelia?
Aurelia.
Aurelia.
Yes.
That their relationship was a relationship quite, in many ways, I think, quite different from the relationship you had with your mother.
Yes, very much so. My grandmother, I've gotten so many nice letters from women who've read the book and are of a certain generation who said, oh, this is my family to a degree, in that my mother was the oldest of six in, I wouldn't call them impoverished, but, a family that was struggling during the Great Depression. That wasn't unusual, especially for a Catholic family. You had a large family. In the case of my grandmother, she'd already come from a rather poor background, and she married my grandfather, who was above her station. Mm-hmm. And I think she had really had these hopes that she was going to have my grandfather and a nice lifestyle and be able to write some books. She was a gifted writer herself. And it was a situation where the babies came one after another. They had the first 5 and 6.5 years. Several miscarriages followed that. It was a total of about 13 pregnancies resulting in six children. And I think my grandmother, her first passion was not motherhood the way it is for a lot of women. And so I think it was, I think so many of the people that I talk about in the book, I tried as best I could to wear my journalist hat and not just a daughter hat as I wrote the book, to talk to so many different people, all of my mother's siblings, her old nun friends, cousins of hers, as well as certainly my father in putting the book together. But I think in doing all of this, to get back to the point of my grandmother, I think she was a victim of circumstance like so many people in the book were. And so what happened was, you have a very tired and overwhelmed, intelligent woman who doesn't want to necessarily be in this situation of wiping runny noses and standing over hot pots of soup or whatnot all day. and all of the other things back in that era, you know, before the days of disposable diapers. I can only imagine, you know, this was not what she'd envisioned. Right. But and so I don't know if I'd say she took it out on her children, but she made it very clear that being a mother was not what her first dream in life was. And I think that happened a lot back then.
Yeah. And your mother revered, I think, her father.
Yes, very much so.
And that, in at least as far as I could tell, led perhaps in part to her becoming a nun.
Absolutely. I think it, and that wasn't unusual back then either. I mean, the Catholic Church, I mean, today, nuns are completely dying out. I mean, that's just a fact. But at the time in which my mother entered the convent, we're talking about the 50s and 60s, that was actually the pinnacle of nuns in America. It was not a time in which, I think we forget this quickly, now it seems like if someone was to go off and join a convent, it's viewed as certainly unusual at the very least, but oftentimes it's viewed as someone's running away from something. My mother, I think, thought she was running to something, like a lot of Catholic women of that era. She felt like this was her means of perhaps seeing the world, saving the world to a degree. She'd had a very good run in high school. She did exceptionally well in high school. She actually was elected to Girls Nation, and you know, not only Girls State, but Girls Nation, and met President Truman in the Rose Garden of the White House. She was quoted in the Indianapolis paper as even a teenager, and her visions for what to do about the Cold War. She was a early champion of the United Nations. And
oh, and I have to break in, Mary. I'm so sorry. This is going so well. We need to take a quick look at the news. We'll be back. Stay with us. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Today we are exploring the bond between mothers and daughters through our visit with Mary Flum Peterson. She has authored the book White Dresses, a memoir of love and secrets, mothers and daughters, and having a wonderful time talking with her, and certainly inviting you to join in with your own questions or comments. What experiences have you had that you talk about with your mother? How did those experiences impact your life? There are other things in the book, too. We're talking about hoarding. We're talking about mental disease. It's a fascinating read. Number to call to join in the conversation, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And Mary, again, thanks so much for joining us. And I want to mention before we go any further, and we'll mention it again later, but in case I forget, you'll be at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee Tuesday at 7.
Right, this evening at 7 o'clock, yep.
Obviously this evening. And then you're traveling to Madison, and you'll be at a Room of One's Own bookstore at 6 p.m. Tomorrow.
That's correct.
So I'm glad to be able to mention that, and we'll mention it hopefully again as the program goes on. Well, you were talking... when I sort of butted in about your mother and relationship with the father and then your mother becoming a nun. And it really was a different time, wasn't it?
It was such a different time. With my when my mother became a nun, what we were discussing is, as many people who are from Catholic families and go back a couple of generations know, it was a very honorable thing to become a nun. And so my mother really felt like this was something that was going to bring her, yes, closer in her faith to God, but also to her father, who she just adored and was a very devout Catholic. And she had a younger sister, actually, who had gone into the convent already. My mother didn't enter the convent until after she'd graduated from college. But her younger sister entered the convent at age 15, which, of course, now just sounds, she was a baby. And even this aunt has since told me, yes, she was a baby. My mother would later liken that to child abuse, sending a child away that young. Because literally, I mean, you become a piece of property of the Catholic Church. church when you become a nun. Certainly back then, I mean, it was the days before internet and cell phones, and you know, your parents drop you off, and that's it. I mean, you're no longer in charge of when you get to. I mean, you don't get to go home for quite some time. Even for visits, people come to visit you. As my children have said, they've likened it a bit to a prison existence, and I don't think my mother would have corrected them that much because of the convent she was in. And I want to be careful about this. I adore many, many nuns, and I think there are some really wonderful convents out there. My husband and I are raising our kids in the church, and they go to Catholic schools, so this is not me trying to bash convents. It is to say that back then in particular, there were some convents that were better than others, and some of them used rather, they were rather draconian. And my mother, unfortunately, she was in an order that they really loved these university-educated women so that they could teach in the schools, but it wasn't a very friendly place by any means, and it was a really dark and awful time. I've since learned, since writing the book and researching about it, that this was not that unusual, but these poor women, when they were subjected to some of these draconian measures, you know, it wasn't just the typical things in the Catholic Church of a lot of food deprivation, a lot of suffering through wearing those horribly huge habits in very hot Indiana summers. You know, in the case of my poor mother, she kept passing out. But it was also things like denying them medical care.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
It was just very primeval. In the case of my mother, she almost died of some things that were going on in her body, and she knew that there was something wrong, but she was told to pray it off. And the thing is, when you're being told to do this in an order in which it's all about hierarchy, and you take these vows of obedience, you know, it puts you in this really strange conundrum of well, what to do, and then who do you report to? I mean, you report that to anybody, and it's just such a closed society, these convents. It was a very just a very strange time. And it's crazy to believe it was less than 100 years ago. When I look back at it, you know, there were these intelligent women that were essentially being held captive, sometimes by women that did not have their best interests at heart. So in any case, it was a very different time. She left the convent after almost a decade, thanks to the help of a wonderful priest who kind of intervened on her behalf, the same one that had gotten her medical help when she was in there. And when she left the convent, it was just a really tough time because there's no support group back then for women. It's not like you leave and you were welcomed with open arms. In many cases, like the case of her family, it was a source of shame. I mean, her yeah. head had basically been shaved when she was in the convent. So she left and, you know, her hair was horrible. She'd lost so much weight. She had no clothes. They threw her out in literally rags because she was stripped of her habit. It was a very odd time. It was even, and because she'd been off the grid for so long, no sooner had she gotten out, and her poor parents didn't know how to deal with any of this, but she got a knock on the door from the IRS because she was being audited because she'd been off the grid for almost 10 years, and they thought that she was, you know, for all they knew, that she was some woman on the run, you know, who for all they knew was some kind of convict. But she said she laughed about that particular memory. But the other memory, she certainly didn't laugh about.
Well, and of course, she eventually married. She went from one, as you say in the book, I think you kind of went from one abusive relationship to another in some ways.
Yes.
When she married your father.
Yes. And there too, I just want to emphasize, I mean, it's, you know, everybody was a victim of circumstance in the family, yeah. And I'm not trying to give anybody a pass, but it really was. I mean, my mother entered the convent, you know, I don't think she would have today because, you know, it was the timing, and it was, you know, had she had a more loving relationship with her mother, or there had been more opportunities for women. Again, when she entered the convent, it was before the women's movement and before Vatican II, which, of course, revolutionized the role of women in the church. In the case of my father, in terms of him being a victim of circumstance, he grew up the only surviving son of an Indiana, a farm family, Southern Indiana, good Catholic family, had an older brother tragically killed. He was the only one carrying on the family name. And so, of course, back then in the 1950s and 1960s, nobody was supposed to be gay. Certainly not a farm boy from a good Catholic family where he had a very you know, I love my grandfather, but a very macho farmer father. And so he really felt like he had no choice other than to carry on this family name. He knew from the time his older brother was killed, there was a lot of pressure for him to take over the farm. He didn't wind up doing that, so he couldn't not only not take over the farm, but also not succeed in producing, ideally some kind of heir to the family name. It would have, in his eyes, killed his parents. And so when he met my mother, they met at Ball State University. My mother, after she got herself back on her feet a couple of years out of the convent, she decided to go back for a master's in speech and language pathology. She'd been a lifelong stutterer, and she really wanted to help others. She and my father met at Ball State when my father was working on his MBA, and I think he saw this good Catholic woman. He knew that she was a former nun, and I think he felt like, okay, this will work. He did not let my mother in on, of course, what he knew was that he, in fact, was gay. And I think that was very typical back then. I'm not saying everyone did it, but, you know, when he did go for advice to a priest about what do I do in terms of he knew the feelings that he was having towards men, before he married my mother, he was advised by the priest, you know, hey, you're not gay. And he married my mother, and really they tried to make a go of it. Of course, my mother was in the dark. She didn't know what was wrong. She just knew something was wrong. My father wound up being very angry, and she didn't know what the source of this problem was. So, yeah, she'd gone from a relationship in the convent in which she had some very angry nuns who didn't treat her very nicely to a relationship with a husband who would get very angry. If anything regarding intimacy came up, which of course it's going to come up if you're sure. intent on starting a family.
Yeah.
It was a tough time.
And eventually you came along.
I did. I came along. You know, I have to credit my father. Some people have asked how he's felt about the book. My father, I couldn't have written this book without my father's help. I wrote the back half of the book first. Each chapter starts with a story of a white dress that was significant in our lives. So I started with the story of my first communion dress, and then I went on through the memories, you know, that I knew for sure. And then I went back and I wrote the first half and talked to my mother's siblings and the things I knew about from my mother, and that I'd written down for school projects and taken notes for family photos over the years, so I could talk about her childhood. And I talked to her nun friends for the nun chapter. And then I got to the chapters about my parents, my mother's wedding dress, and my baptism dress, and I had to talk to my father. And he knew the book was coming, and he knew I was really trying to be a good journalist, and I really credit him. So when I came along, my father, there were a couple of years into the marriage. They'd successfully had my brother. My father knew he was really unhappy. And he saw when my mother was pregnant with me, this is his account to me, I had no way of knowing this otherwise. He was very open with me in our interviews. He'd seen an article in Time magazine in 1972 about public bathhouses and the role they were playing as a growing number of men were coming out. And for him, it was it spoke to him. And so, it was bittersweet to find out that when my mother was very pregnant with me, he was making his first visits to the public bathhouses, in this case on a business trip up in Minneapolis. And that was a real turning point. Of course, my poor mother still didn't know what was going on. It would take a few more years and unfortunately a couple of suicide attempts on the part of my father before they finally understood, she finally understood, you know, what was really troubling him. But it was a hard time for her.
And a very hard time for. And you mentioned, was it confirmation in the book? You say that was kind of your last, you know, happy time as a young person.
First communion. That was right around the time that he left, but he came back for that. And my father, you know, I'd still see him. My mother was extremely ahead of her time in terms of she could have become very bitter and angry when my father left, and she opted not to be. I mean, she really realized pretty quickly. I write about it in the book because my father told me it was the most loving thing anyone had ever said to him was when he was trying to come to terms with being gay. My mother took his hand and said, you know, if I can accept who you are, why can't you? So she really tried to be so supportive and channel that former nun within, mm-hmm. of just being very accepting of others. That said, it was very hard on her being in a small town back in the 80s. It's obviously changed so much. But back then, many people believed nobody was gay. But on this first communion day, it was nice. I knew that something was off. My father had left. My mother was sad. The house was starting to become messier, which, of course, I go on to talk about in the book. I didn't realize, no one knew what hoarding was. I didn't realize that was starting to set in. But on that particular day, I just loved that first communion dress. It was a beautiful day. It was the first weekend in May. Traditionally, that's when first communions are in the parish I was at in Beaver Dam, Wisconsin. And it was just a really, we all know it's spring is coming here in Wisconsin right now, that when finally the snow is melted and the tulips are up, and it was very magical. I remember just loving that day more than anything and never wanting to take that dress off.
And of course, so you had a pretty tough childhood because, for a variety of reasons, your mom was I'm sure it was financially it was a problem a little bit,
and very much so.
Yeah, and then her own. I mean, you loved your mother, and you had a very close relationship with her.
I did.
She really. Probably spent more time with you in some ways when you were young than the average mother might.
I think that's very true with single mothers. Any single mothers out there, you're the heroes of the world. You truly are. I bow down to you. I think single mothers just are superheroes and angels all rolled into one here on earth. And drill sergeants, as you have to be. But single mothers are amazing. And my mom really, I mean, she was that single mom who... And this is back in the days, you know, I was a latchkey child from the time I was five. I mean, when my dad left, I mean, they didn't have a really good system in place. I mean, there was, you know, it was typical back then. My mother had been staying home. She'd lost any accreditation for teaching. So when he left and he had to set himself up with an apartment, I mean, there just wasn't enough money to go around. She needed to go back to work, but to go back to work, she had to go back to school. The list goes on. So, you know, I was a latchkey kid from the time I was five. And even though she was working and she was going to school a couple of nights a week, I mean, some nights she wasn't home until 9 o'clock. And I was small. It's amazing what a single mother can do when she puts her mind to it. I still felt very loved and very looked after, in spite of her absences from the house. I mean, she was always there in spirit, and she certainly, you know, there was never a day that failed to begin or end without her, you know, giving great big hugs and kisses and declarations of I love you. She was definitely that single mom that anything she really needed or wanted went way by the wayside. It was all about her children. I was very fortunate that despite how dark some things got, and I don't want people to think the book is all dark. I mean, it's
no.
A story really of a lot of love.
Yes.
And a lot of... just persevering, which was what she so believed in. You know, when the going gets tough, I mean, she wasn't a bad drill sergeant of saying the tough get going, but she was just saying always gently, you know, okay, you can have a good cry, but then you get back up and you keep going. There wasn't much choice. So I was very fortunate through the storm of life. I always say, you know, she was that wonderful, like all of you single moms out there, that wonderful, wonderful spirit that, you know, she just got us through anything.
And she supported your writing and your journalism career to some extent.
She did. She did. She was a wonderful writer, and as her mother had been before. I mean, for me, I'm very fortunate. It really literally ran, and it was in our blood. And so she encouraged me to start writing my first short stories. She, as well as I had, some wonderful teachers over the years. I went to a wonderful elementary school in Beaver Dam, Wisconsin, that really encouraged me to write. And she encouraged me to write and to write my first plays, my first short stories. I started winning contests in junior high and high school, in large part because she encouraged me. She'd say, hey, there's a contest. Why don't you enter that? Or, hey, it would be both local and national contests. So she was very encouraging of all that. Later on, I think it became hard for her when things really started to take off. When I went to Columbia University in college, and I my junior year, I started my internship at CNN. And then when I really was falling in love with TV news, I think she was so happy for me. But I think there was that part of her, as I hit that age where she had entered the convent in early 20s, and then suddenly I was out seeing the world and doing what I think she would have been exceptional at, you know, if she'd gone into journalism. So that's where I think some people have told me, as they've read the book, they've enjoyed what they call the terms of endearment moments, where the very loving mother and daughter, but sometimes at loggerheads, as a lot of us women know you can be. You can just dearly love each other, and you've got some of that friction. And so some of that did start, I think, where... And she even admitted it. She said she sometimes had really healthy cases of jealousy. Like, why didn't I know that that was out there? You know, why didn't I know that I could have gone and worked for a city paper or something? And, you know, but the difference was I had a mother who encouraged me to look for those avenues. And she had a mother that was so overwhelmed or caught up in her own world she wasn't able to.
Oh. What do you think your mother would think of your book?
I think she would like it. And I see this for a couple of reasons. I'm not just saying this, you know, because I want to be clear. I think even when some family members first heard I was writing this book about my mother, I think they were so fearful it was going to be some kind of mommy dearest. And I said, but no, I love my mother. This is nothing but, you know, she loved complicated family sagas. She never believed that any family was as neat and tidy and perfect as some would like to be or seem. And certainly in Facebook generation, I think she would be fearful of how perfect all of us are trying to be. She always loved the complicated Catholic family sagas. The Thornbirds was always a favorite novel because of how all of the inherent character flaws in all of us. And of course, those in a family drama, you know, the way they play out. And at the end of the day, though, of course, there too, there was a lot of a big story of love. So I think she would like the fact that there's complications and nuance, that these people are not. She didn't like these neatly drawn characters in any book, especially if someone purported to have it be a true story where everything was all neat and tidy and clean. I think she would have embraced that. And she was a big advocate for getting the word out of helping others in the situation of mental health, which I know, you know, we haven't talked a whole lot about. And she unfortunately didn't allow us to get the help we wanted her to get for the hoarding. For the depression, though, she was a huge advocate for letting people know that it's real, and you know, that people are not alone. So that I think she also would have embraced, insofar as she was a big advocate. If she knew people in the community were suffering, she never wanted them to suffer in silence. She wanted people to know, you know, that she'd been through it and that they weren't alone. So I think she would like that aspect of the book, because at the end of the day, she always believed, again, you know, not to sound too cheesy, but tomorrow is another day and whatnot. And for those suffering with mental illness, she wanted people to know that, again, they're not alone.
Mary, this has been wonderful. I have to apologize to our callers for not getting them on. You were such a wonderful interview today, and we didn't get close to covering everything in your book, obviously. And I'm hoping that folks join a stop by Boswell Books Company in Milwaukee tonight at 7. You got a book signing there. And then you'll be in Madison at A Room of One's Own bookstore tomorrow evening at 6 o'clock. And the book's doing well?
It's doing great. It hit the New York Times bestseller list in a couple of spots just a week ago on March 20th. So that's been very exciting. So thank you for all who've read it. And anyone stopping by tonight or tomorrow night, I'm actually bringing some of the real white dresses with me. And I'd love to give some big, big hugs to everybody. So I'll have several of the real white dresses with me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being with us today, Mary. Mary Flum Peterson, author of White Dresses, a memoir of love and secrets, mothers and daughters. Boswell Book Company tonight at 7 for a signing, and A Room of One's Own in Madison tomorrow at 6. Stay with us. Lots in store.